Welcome to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection, where Colorado trial lawyers share insights from their latest cases. Join me, Keith Fuselli, as we uncover the stories, strategies, and lessons from recent Colorado trials to help you and your clients achieve justice in the courtroom. The pursuit of justice starts now. Welcome, everyone, back to an episode of the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection, where we really try to interview Colorado trial lawyers once they've had a case, presumably had success on that case, we can all learn from that. And I know a little bit about this case we're about to talk about, and I could not be happier to have the chance to talk to Glenn Fair and Emily Jameson from the Oakmont Law Group about a truly amazing result on the type of case that I'm certain we all have many, many cases in our inventory that fit this story. So with that, welcome Glenn and Emily.
Thank you, Keith. Good to be here.
Happy to be here as well.
Great. Well, before we kind of jump into this case, I always like to ask people a little bit about how they came to be trial lawyers. And Emily, why don't we start with you? Have you always wanted to be a trial lawyer? Do you know that since you were a little kid, or is that something you found out later?
This is honestly one of the last jobs I expected myself to have growing up. I was a pretty shy kid. So yeah, I was originally interested in kind of like criminal justice type work, eventually wound up going to law school and then trial my first year of law school and really enjoyed it. So kind of started shifting in this direction. But I'm kind of a baby trial lawyer at this point. I was just admitted in October of 22. So this was my first civil jury trial.
Well, the good news is you're undefeated. And that means when you win your first trial, it means you're bound to just win them all from here on out. So you get to be in that category of never having lost a civil jury trial. So bravo. What a way to start. That's awesome. Glenn, what about you? Tell us a little bit about Oakmont Law Group and how you came to become a trial lawyer.
I'm 57 now. I was in the military, did some administration work after that. And my dream when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a cop or I wanted to be a lawyer. And so I broke into law enforcement in my early 20s. I suffered a career-ending injury back in 2013. Before I had the surgery that we're pretty sure was going to end my career, I took the LSAT because I'd finished undergrad. I'm like, well, I'm only 47. I can't just do nothing at 47. So my wife and I decided, you know what? We both have our bachelor's. Let's go to law school. So took the LSAT, did okay. It wasn't great, wasn't horrible. Applied to a bunch of law schools and decided to go to University of Wyoming because it was close to the Denver area where we knew we were going to end up. So we did that. Law school was great. Graduated at 50 and then went and worked for a firm that, I'm trying to put it nicely, worked for a firm that just, I mean, it was a lot of get them in, get them settled, get them out. And cases did get filed. I was only there a year. In the year I was there, they tried one case to verdict, but I wasn't really happy with the way things were going there. I didn't feel like that was the best way to serve people. That's been my life, is serving people, serving our country in the military, serving my community as a law enforcement officer. And so I knew I wanted to stay in personal injury. I considered criminal law, but after a career in criminal law, I've had enough. I figured the next best way to help people was do the personal injury work. And so I left that other firm and left there on a Friday was my last day. I cleaned my office out and left. And on Monday morning, I opened up Oakmont Law Group. And I had a business partner with me, great guy, helped me get started. We're no longer working together, but we're still friends. And we started doing personal injury cases. Found Nick Rowley at some point in the early 2019, really dug in 2020 and started running with the bull stuff come 2021. And here we are. Sorry, you got lawyers, long answer.
Right? No, it was perfect and so inspirational. So my first question is, what branch of the military were you in?
I was in the Army. I served in the 82nd Airborne Division. And I'm going to date myself. Like I said, I went in 1985 and I got out in 1988. I never saw combat. I was in that gap between Grenada and before Desert Storm. Okay. And so I did my 3 years and got out and got on with my life.
Well, thank you for your service. I'm the son of a Navy brat, so traveled all over the country and just have a real appreciation for anyone that puts themselves out there. And a huge kudos to you for graduating law school at age 50 and pursuing your passion. That is awesome. My real question for you is, I'm hearing that you worked at a firm that maybe didn't have the same values that you had as far as how cases should be handled and how they should be worked up and how they ultimately resolve. So what are the values that you try to instill at Oakmount that you learned you wanted to be different than the firm you started out at, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So Oakmount, we're really people-focused. The ethos of our company is that we take care of people first. And if you take care of the people well and you do your job right, the money will take care of itself. And we have really found that. It's one of our core values is people first. And then one of our other values for our employees is to make sure that our team members get a great work-life balance. Emily's the first, actually she's the second associate we've hired, but the first one we've hired on salary. And while admittedly, we don't pay what some of the big firms pay, I don't think Emily's had to work more than 40 hours a week other than the week of trial since she started here. And so that's one of the big selling points for our firm is you're almost never going to work more than 40 hours a week. We take care of our clients. That's what we're here to do. And I think applying a lot of the running with the bulls and trial by human principles and the stuff from Keith Mitnick and whatnot, which we can get into later, I think that really lends itself to getting maximum justice. I mean, at the other firm I was at, it was a lot of haggling with insurance adjusters. In the last 3 years, I have had a grand total of 5 phone calls with insurance adjusters.
Wow.
I just don't talk to them anymore. And for 2 reasons. Number one, we get more policy limit tenders than we get offers for less. And granted, our caseload's only about 125, so that's still pretty decent. We find ourselves in lawsuit about 35% of the time, and we're trying about 10% of those.
Great. That's a lot. So, I mean, it sounds like you're going to trial with some regularity.
We're really working on that. We also have a criminal practice here. So my wife leads up the criminal defense division. She was also in law enforcement for a little while. So she does that. So I've had a handful of criminal jury trials, which is super helpful because most of them are a day or two and you get it done. And then the civil jury trials, to coin a Nick Rowley phrase, the being brutally honest, this trial we got this verdict on was only my 4th civil jury trial. It was my 5th civil trial total, but only my 4th jury trial. It was really scary because we lost the last two. So we won the first one, we lost number 2, we lost number 3, and then we hit a home run on number 4.
Yeah. Do you find, I have been in similar shoes where I don't know if this is true for you, but you find yourself sort of questioning, what am I doing wrong? Is it me? Is it the case? Did those types of thoughts enter into your mind after having that string of losses?
Absolutely. It was after the first loss, I mean, we had no idea what had we done wrong, what happened. And I relied on some of my mentors and whatnot and talked to them about it. Sometimes that just doesn't go your way. We weren't able to pin anything down really specific about that case. What the consensus seems to be on that case was they just didn't believe our client, which was very surprising to me because I thought she was wonderful.
Yeah,
I was starting to question whether it's like, gosh, am I really cut out for doing this? Have I done something wrong? The first case where we won, we, again, followed the stuff I've learned from trial lawyers way better than me. We waived our $26,000 in meds. We asked the jury for several million dollars and they gave us about $400,000. But the $400,000 they gave us was, you know, was all uncapped. And so we were like, hey, this stuff works. And then the second one, we get a defense verdict. I know why we lost the third one. It was one of those things where you tell your client and tell your client and tell your client, don't post stuff on social media during the pendency of your case because the defense is going to find it. I mean, we looked, we didn't find it. Somehow the defense found a video that was really damaging to our client. And my mentors all said, the second that video played, the case was over. There was no way you could save it. So we had a year gap in trying cases because just how the way it goes. We were really wanting to get back in the courtroom. We don't find reasons to settle. We find reasons to try cases. But we started getting, Jason Jordan says, they started putting the fruit hanging low enough. Our clients were like, I'll take $500,000.
Right.
So I don't have to go to trial. And so that's been happening. So this February 2024, this was our first trial this year. We've got 2 more coming up, 1 in June, 1 in July. Both of those are likely going to go. We're doing our best to get cases in front of juries unless carriers are kicking down the full policy limits.
Yeah, well, kudos to you. You're obviously doing a lot right. to get to trial. And one of the questions I have about doing a lot right is I think I heard you say that the first case you tried where you had an amazing result, you waived economics. And then correct me if I'm wrong, but the case we're going to talk about here in just a few minutes also waived economics. Is that right?
That's true. I've actually waived economic damages in every single one of my civil trials.
Wow.
Yeah. And so for the one case, it was a construction case. It was a negligence case based on premises liability against a construction company.
Okay.
Meds in that were only $26,000. Our client had a very compelling story. He was a great guy. And he still is a great guy. And we focused on his non-economic losses with his family and his kids and how it's impacted him. And we got a mid-six-figure verdict. In the second case, the first one we lost, meds on that were 74, 75. We waived those.
Wow.
Because we thought her story was more compelling. And the same thing in number four and our number three and number four. One of the big foundations of the running with the bulls and how it works at Trial by Human, if the listeners don't know, Nick Rowley has a company called Trial Lawyers for Justice, got lawyers all over the country who help and they teach and they basically use his stuff. And I talk about Nick a lot because number one, he's a good dude. Number two, he's probably one of the best trial lawyers I've ever met. And what he's doing works. And while I don't want to be Nick Rowley, I'd like to be the Glenn Fair version of Nick Rowley, you know, with that type of success.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I too, of course, am a huge Nick Rowley fan and did attend the first Trial by Human seminar in Boulder. And I know from reading your summary of this that you attended a recent Trial by Human seminar in Montana. So for the listeners, do you recommend attending an in-person Trial by Human seminar? And what have you learned from Nick Rowley and Trial by Human that you implement in your actual day-to-day practice?
That's a huge question. So let's see if I could break it down into pieces. So in July 2021, Trial by Woman is the company that puts it on. That's run by Courtney Rowley, Nick's wife. So Trial by Woman and Trial by Human put on, I think it was an 8 or 9 day trial seminar at the Big Sky Ranch up in Montana, Big Sky, Montana. And so we went up there and you're expected to bring a case or two. And I had one that was getting ready to go to trial. And basically we worked on case pieces. We'd sit down and work on voir dire. And then literally you'd stand up and practice voir dire for your case. You'd practice opening. You'd practice directs. I tell everybody, if you can get to a Trial by Human event, you got to go. You got to go. You just don't get this stuff elsewhere. And like I said, Trial Lawyers for Justice and Trial by Woman, Trial by Human, they have, the Rowleys and their crew have got it nailed down. And insurance companies just don't know what to do with themselves. They think they do, but they don't.
Well, and what I love about your case, and maybe what we'll do is we'll jump into your case, is you look at people like Nick and Courtney Rowley, and they're hitting $50, $100 million verdicts on these catastrophic cases. And you think, well, maybe those lessons don't apply to my cases. But I think what we're about to hear from this case is they absolutely apply to all level of cases and you end up with amazing results. And so, Emily, maybe we could toss it on over to you. Tell us a little bit about the case that you and Glenn tried. What are the facts?
This is a little bit of an old case. It started March of 2020, right around the beginning of the pandemic. Our client, Corey, was just, I think he was driving back from taking his daughter to work. And a driver came out of an alley going in a van going, you know, way faster than you should be driving out of an alley where you can't see oncoming traffic and just kind of crashed right into him, sort of head on, like hit the front driver's side of his car. And then the driver said, like, oh, I don't have a license, and took off. So pretty traumatizing event for our client.
At-fault driver fled the scene of the crash?
He did. The police had to call his boss to make him come back to the scene after they arrived.
And sort of jumping way far ahead, but did that fact come into trial as evidence?
It did, yeah. The opposing counsel for the case did file a motion in limine to exclude the suspended license part of things, but we really were focused on, you know, the non-economic damages, the mental pain and suffering, and part of that was Corey's trauma from being the victim of a hit-and-run crash. And you know, he gave some really powerful testimony when he was on the stand. I think the line that really stood out was like, as the guy was driving away, he's like, he just thought there would be no justice in this case. So we were able to bring all of that in to kind of support the mental distress component.
Let me ask a follow-up on that specific piece, because I was lucky to work under Rich Cotty for a while. And he sort of taught me that when you have a case like that, you plead the emotional distress that comes from that event, be it a drunk driver, be it someone that flees the scene. So you can have an admitted negligence case, but the bad facts for the defense come in as it relates to the non-economic damages. So my question is, did you plead that in the complaint? And did you list it as a specific element of non-economic damages in your A1 disclosures?
Well, I will toss that to Glenn because I was not working here at the time the complaint was filed.
So yeah, to answer your question, Keith, yes, we pled that he fled the scene. We specifically plead Chapter 6 of the Colorado Pattern Jury Instructions. We list out all those items, physical, past and future, physical and mental pain and suffering, past and future, economics, and I won't go over the whole thing, but we specifically plead the emotional distress element and the others, just because, I mean, that's really the focus of our cases, is that and physical impairment.
Did you plead specifically the emotional distress as a result of the defendant fleeing the scene of the crash? Do you remember if that was in your A1s?
It was not in the A1s, but it was discussed in Corey's deposition. And just so you know, we have talked to Corey, and he said, please spread the word far and wide. You can use my name and tell people about it because I want justice for others. It's notable that Corey is a Black man, and he was really skeptical about getting justice in a system that's run mostly by non-Blacks. And he was very pleased with his result, and he wants other people to know, hey, there is justice out there. You just have to get the right lawyers.
Glenn, what was your venue for this, venue and judge?
So we were in Adams County, and so up in Brighton, and our judge was the Honorable Arturo Hernandez. It was actually his first civil jury trial, and one of our motions hearings was literally 5 minutes after he got sworn onto the bench.
Wow.
His history was as a district attorney. He litigated a lot of cases. I think he did a good job. Obviously, I don't agree with everything he did, but I believe he followed the rules and followed the law, and I believe he got it right.
So quick question, because you mentioned that your client was an African-American male. Did you raise that in voir dire or not raise that in voir dire? I don't know which way I would go on that. It seems like
we really didn't. I mean, that can really backfire on you. If it looks like I'm the old white guy, if it looks like the old white guy trying to play the race card,
yeah,
that's going to turn some people off. That's not going to fly.
Yep.
And I talked to Corey about it, and I told him I'm not going to bring it up in voir dire. I said, but if it needs to come in at some point in trial, are you okay with that? And he's like, absolutely. And Emily, during the cross of the redirect, we called the defendant our case in chief, Emily crafted a set of redirect questions very quickly that basically exposed the at-fault driver. We believe, it's our opinion, that the at-fault driver was a bit of a racist. That's our opinion. Emily can tell you about that when we get to the talking about the at-fault driver.
Yeah, Emily, I mean, well, now you've piqued my interest, I guess. How did you plant it? I'm assuming you kind of plant a seed with the jury that maybe this guy's a racist. Tell us more about that. Fascinated.
Yeah, well, like Glenn said, he came up on a redirect. So when we brought him up in our case in chief, I kind of just kept it to, you know, getting him to admit that he had fled the scene and that he didn't have a valid license at the time. But when opposing counsel came up for his questioning, he kind of got the defendant to say a lot of things about how, oh, he just fled the scene because he was so scared of the driver. He was like, oh, worried he was going to be violent. And to me, it gave off strong vibes of, oh, you know, the big scary Black man's going to come get me sort of thing. It's like, okay, well, I have to address that on redirect. Glenn and Corey gave me the okay to go ahead with my questions there. So I didn't feel like I could go up and just directly ask him, like, okay, are you just saying that because he's Black? So I had to kind of go about it carefully, kind of ask him, like, okay, tell me why you were scared of my client. Like, and I had a feeling that he would not be able to give me a good non-racist answer. And I turned out to be correct about that. He kind of went off a lot about, like, oh, it was a bad neighborhood, that sort of thing. And then I was like, okay, so you would have run from anyone. He was like, no, 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 not just anyone. It's like, okay, just my client. So I didn't, you know, come out right saying anything, you know, racist, but I felt like the implication came across to the jurors.
For sure, for sure. So Glenn, what were your, let's kind of cut to the chase, go to the end. What were your client's damages? And then how did the verdict break down? And then we can go into some of the specifics of that.
So again, like I've been saying, we really focus on non-economics and physical impairment. But our client's injuries in the crash, he suffered some disc bulging in his neck. He suffered some tears in his shoulders, right and left. He suffered bruising to his knees. He's a taller gentleman. Like, I think I'm 6'2", and I think Corey's about 6'2" as well. And also had a disc herniation at L5-S1 with an annular tear that was pressing on the S1 nerve root. So basically, he was getting radiating pain just into his glutes and into his hips. The pain didn't radiate to his legs until they did, I forget the name of the test that the doctors do to discover that nerve impingement. When they did that test, the pain shot all the way down to his heel. Those were his injuries. Corey was terrified of having needles anywhere near his spine, despite the doctors telling him, hey, it is safe. Yes, there are risks. Some of those risks are paralysis and death. It could happen. It's rare, but it could. And he elected not to do those things. So Corey, he's been an athlete his entire life. He ran high school track, he played all kinds of sports, started a family young, but stayed in the gym. All of his life activities with his family and his friends were all surrounding fitness and doing things like that. And I'd asked him for a picture for our opening PowerPoint. Yeah. Of, you know, you just have a picture of you before the crash. And he happened to have a picture of him working out that was taken almost a month before the crash to the day. And you see that picture, and I described it to the jury during closing. He's a paragon of fitness. This is who he was. He was a paragon of fitness. 45 years of medical history of nothing. We looked. That's something we do for our trials. Yeah. For every client, we go back 5 years. And for cases that are going to get tried, we frequently go back 10 years. And we looked, and the only doctors he'd been to were like Kaiser. And there was nothing in those records for years past, except I got a cold. You know, I got a cold. I need to get my immunizations and whatnot. And so we use that as part of a timeline to show this is all crash cause, despite what their expert says.
Yeah.
So damage dollar-wise. His medical bills, because he declined to do any injections and didn't want to talk about a microdiscectomy, he just said, look, I'm going to do my home exercise programs that I were given. I'm going to do some massage work that he knows how to do. And I'm just going to do the best I can because, sure, I'm in pain every day. Yeah. Or actually, that's not what he said. He said he's in pain most days and nights are the worst. He says, but it's not debilitating. He's like, it's like level 2, level 3 pain. And this is what we told the jury. We didn't tell him he's laying on the floor agonizing. It bothers him. If you read Keith Mitnick's Don't Eat the Bruises, it's the pilot light pain analogy, crick in the neck analogy. I use that in closing. Yeah. So Corey figures he's going to manage. And he knows at some point that degeneration is going to get him.
Yeah.
And he's going to have some type of an invasive procedure. But he's going to put that off as long as possible. So his medical bills were only $37,000. And we waived those. The only time we're not going to waive medical bills is if we've got probably $300,000 or $400,000 in bills. But then we're waiving them up to $100,000 almost as a matter of practice.
Wow.
And so Corey also lost one of his businesses. So he runs a vape shop, and he had it was massage. And then he stopped doing massage and started doing Reiki energy work and stretching. And he was doing that. And then when the crash occurred and the disc herniation, the other injuries occurred, he couldn't do it. It's not that he couldn't do it. I want to caution the listeners. That's a trick question from the defense. When they ask your client in deposition, what can you not do anymore? And it wasn't that he couldn't do it. In his deposition, he testified, look, I can still do these things, but I pay for it. And it hurts a lot for days after.
Sure.
He can only stand to do massage work for 20 to 30 minutes. Well, that's not going to work when all your massages are an hour.
Yeah.
And then because of the issues with his shoulders, he couldn't do some of the stretching work. So he lost his massage business. We hired Jeff Opp as our forensic economist. And Corey went in and explained, he's like, look, my plan is I was only going to work till 60. And so Jeff opted an economic loss report for his business up to the age of 60. That number was about $460,000.
Let me jump in on that. Did the defense hire anyone to rebut that? So we're talking 400 plus in economic losses, economic future wage loss. Did the defense hire anyone to contest that?
They did not. Early on in the case, after we sent our first settlement opportunity letter, the adjuster said, we're not buying the wage loss claim. We want his tax returns. And so we thought about it. And because he doesn't have W-2s, we thought about it. And we decided to give them pre-litigation his last 5 year tax returns. We ordered them straight for the IRS and turned them over. And their response to that was they offered like an extra $2,000.
Okay.
They had that information for about 2 years before the trial, and they never did anything with it. Their excuse was, well, he was going to lose that business because of COVID anyways.
Okay.
That's what the adjuster told us. And so we made sure to address that with Jeff Opp, and they dug into it, and he testified about that in trial, how, you know, he's like, I already deducted off for COVID. I deducted all that off, so we're not even asking for replacement of that money. And so that seemed to go over well with it.
Let me see if I can summarize. So you've got 30-something in economics that you waive in medical bills. You've got 400 in wage loss economics that you keep. And what was the result? What was the verdict, and how was it broken down?
The verdict was just a few thousand dollars short of $2.2 million. The jury gave us every penny that Jeff Opp said that he lost, past and future. So they literally just took his number and put it on the verdict form. For non-economic damages, the pain and suffering, emotional distress damages, they gave us $572,220. The way I argued it in closing was designed to make sure we don't have $1 million in a capped category.
So tell us about that, because I know that is the sweet spot we're all looking for. Tell us the arguments you used to get them to put it in impairment and not non-economics.
So what I did was towards the end of my closing, I pulled up a verdict form, and it was two pages. It wasn't the verdict form where we have a form A, form B. We used the unified form. So it was, you know, the questions about the causation and level of damages. And so I had that screen up. And of course, I didn't rehash everything. I just hit the high points. Yes, the causation's there. Yes, the damages are there. Then I got to the other screen, which is the important one, or the other card, which is the amount. Non-economic was first. And I explained to them, you know, I think it should be $730,000, understanding that was a little above the cap. But I wanted to be true to my numbers, because the way I came up with the number was I looked at how much did Corey make in the 5 years before the crash in his businesses.
Okay.
And I took the lowest year, his lowest year of income out of those, added up the total of his profit and divided that by 2080, which is the number of hours you work in a year. And I came up with a number of $33.13 an hour.
Okay.
And I explained to the jury, I said he should get $33.13 an hour. And I had this up on the screen for the jurors to see. I said, and the reason he should get that is not because some attorney just came up with that number. The reason he should get that's because the citizens of his community patronized his business and gave them money that equaled that much. So the citizens of his community says he's worth $33.13 an hour. And so he should get that amount from the date of the crash until the day of trial started for 16 hours a day. And I use 16 hours a day because jurors in my other trials have told me, basically, if they're not missing an arm or a leg, they're not buying the 24 hours a day.
Okay.
It was just harder for them to believe. And so I wanted to make sure to keep that credibility with the jury. And so we went 16 hours a day, 1,445 days, 730 grand. Economics, we just wrote Jeff Opp's number down there. And physical impairment, what I did for that is, because I did that for the 1,445 days plus the 11,899 days left in his life, according to the census tables.
Yep.
And on that, I asked for $11.10 an hour.
Okay.
And I explained to the jury, the reason I'm asking for a third is because you heard Corey testify, it doesn't bother him all the time. Mm. But it bothers him a lot at night when he sleeps. And that's a third of his life.
Okay.
And so I wanted to use a number that was fair and realistically represented what his suffering was worth. And I said, the reason this belongs in physical impairment is because the disc in his back that was fine before this crash with no symptoms and no indication of pain for 45 years was not that way after the crash. That disc was physically changed. And talking to the jury, I said, and you could see that physical change. You saw it with your own eyes. MRIs don't lie. You saw where the disc was sticking out. You saw where the disc was laying on the nerve root. He wasn't born that way. And since he wasn't born that way, his physique, his physical condition has now been impaired. You know, Colorado doesn't have a definition for that. And I believe that that injury that described and the testimony they heard and the images they saw supports as a physical impairment. And that's where the damages need to go at $11.10 an hour for like 13,000 days, which was a couple million dollars.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what did that end number look like?
The final total I had on the board for the jurors was $3.55 million.
Okay. And they gave you, remind me again, $2 million?
2.2.
Did they tell you to talk to the jurors afterwards?
We didn't. When we were in the parking lot, it snowed the day before and later in the day, you know how that goes. And the jurors, if they wanted to talk to us, could meet us downstairs. And we didn't hang around because it's Adams County. There's not much room to stand and we had all our gear. So we were walking out to the parking lot. We did see the jurors walking out and Corey just waved and said, thank you. And the jury foreman said, we are so sorry you were hurt. We hope you get better.
Wow.
That's all that was said. So it's obvious that the jury clearly believed what we were saying, which was, I mean, it was really just the truth, you know, and we just were able to show it. With interest, it's going to be right at $3
million. Wow, $3 million. It was a million-dollar policy, right?
Million-dollar policy, which we believe was open, and we told them that because they had three chances to settle that claim within the policy limits, having all the information that we had. And I told them, I'm going to go in and I'm going to ask the jury for a minimum of $2.5 million, mostly non-economics and physical impairment.
Yeah.
They ignored me.
And it was Matthew Buckle was opposing counsel, so in-house at Farmers.
Yeah, Matthew's in-house at Farmers. And, you know, I mean, we all deal with a lot of lawyers on the other side. We talked about core values earlier. One of our principles in this office is you be kind.
Yes.
Be kind. You be polite. You be professional. We do not yell and scream at people. We don't make threats. We just tell them what we're going to do, and then we go do it. And we found that Matt, he was very receptive to that. And obviously, we didn't agree on a whole lot of stuff, but we got the job done. We were polite, professional. I'd be okay trying another case against Matt. He was not difficult to deal with.
Yeah, agree. Emily, let me ask you a question, because I know there was, from reading your review of this case, a fair amount of pretrial motions work. So could you talk to us a little bit about either motions in limine that you filed proactively or responded to, and how motions practice in this case ended up affecting the outcome?
Yeah, like I said, there was a fair amount of motions practice in this case. We filed 11 motions proactively. That said, the ones that weren't agreed to by opposing counsel, the judge kind of deferred on. Judge Hernandez, like we said, is pretty new, so he was kind of like wanting to save all of his rulings till trial when he knew what was going on there. Our defensive motions practice, kind of mentioned earlier, opposing counsel filed a motion to exclude any testimony about the defendant's suspended license. He filed that like less than 2 weeks before trial, I think it was. So I had to kind of scramble to respond to that before the deadline. And we were able to get the judge to rule in our favor there. It's kind of based on the argument that, kind of like I mentioned earlier, the hit and run is part of the damages, and discussing the suspended license is really closely intertwined with the hit and run, since like the guy shouted, sorry, I don't have a license, as he was leaving. So we were able to get that in.
Let me interrupt you, because I'm fascinated by this, because I can see a judge trying to slip the baby, thinking, okay, well, I'm going to let in that he fled. But the fact that he didn't have, the reason he fled was because he had a suspended license. Do you believe that it is only because the defendant told your client at the scene, I don't have a license, and bailed, that it came in?
I think it's largely because that's what he said to my client as he was leaving, just because that makes it, you know, it's hard to get the story out of the client effectively if we're trying to, you know, step around certain details and whatnot. It makes it just difficult for us to put on our case. And I think the judge understood that.
Fascinating. So judge allowed that. And were there any other motions part of this that jump out as being sort of critically important?
Yeah. On the discovery end of things, I did have to file a motion to compel. We haven't talked much about the defense expert yet, but Dr. Stoll did not want to comply with our subpoena deuces tecum. So we had quite the argument over that, and we were mostly successful.
Great. I definitely want to talk about that. So we won't talk specific numbers, but am I correct that you served Dr. Stoll with a subpoena deuces tecum to produce evidence of his income, and the court granted that, and you had that information at trial? Is that accurate?
Yeah. So in our motion to compel, our three kind of big things, we wanted the evidence of his income specifically related to medical legal work. We wanted some of his past IME reports so we could kind of see what sort of patterns showed up and how he assessed cases. And then so related to the subpoena, but he wanted to charge us over $2,000 an hour for the deposition. So we had quite the fight over costs there as well.
So you raised this proactively, and I believe that Glenn offered before to share your subpoena, and I'm not sure about the motions associated therewith, but hopefully, I know you guys are more than happy to help everyone out. So that issue all gets raised before Judge Hernandez on motions in motion to compel. What was the ruling on each of those three issues from the court?
Yeah, so the judge did, regarding the financials, we'd initially asked for tax returns. So upon kind of conferring with Dr. Stoll's counsel, we kind of walked that back a bit to agree to an affidavit from Dr. Stoll about his income and the percentage of that that came from defense versus plaintiff's work. So the judge did grant our motion to get that affidavit. Our boss was having it under a protective order, so we can't discuss the specifics here. But we did get that financial information that was super helpful to us. We got a portion of the medical reports that we had asked for as well, that were illuminating and seeing, you know, what sort of arguments Dr. Stoll likes to make when he's neutrally assessing patients. But and we also got his fees cut down by more than half for the deposition. So that was pretty nice.
And did you take the deposition or did Glenn take the deposition?
Glenn did. I was present, but I haven't done an expert deposition yet. So.
Okay, well, they're all as easy and work out as well as they did in this case. So no worries going forward. Glenn, could you talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on deposing Dr. Stoll and sort of what your goals were? Because I know some people, they think, I don't want to deal with the hassle. I don't want to pay the money. Other people say, always depose every expert, every case. So curious your thoughts on that.
I don't even call them IMEs because they're not independent. We all know that. Anybody who's done this work knows they're not truly independent. And there are times I'll actually file motions and limines about that. So for the Rule 35 examiners, what I want to do is I want to lock in their story. I want to find out, what are you an expert in? What are you not an expert in? So that when we get, you know, when he gets up on the stand, he's not going to suddenly try to sandbag us with, oh, I'm also familiar and an expert in billing because I, you know, I owned a medical practice. And he testified that he's not a billing expert. So I wanted to lock in his area of expertise to start with. After that, what I wanted to do was see if I could understand where he's coming from on his report and grab what Keith Mitnick calls sound bites for a cross-exam. And so what I'm thinking of when I'm doing this is, why does he believe what he believes? I'm not going to argue the medicine with him. That's pointless. He's a surgeon. He's going to kick our butts. And so I'm not going to argue it with him, but I want to find out why he's saying it. And basically, he said, because of Corey's age, he was about 44, 45 at the time of the crash, despite the fact that he had no history, the disc bulges and herniations are all related to pre-existing degeneration, that his shoulder injuries were most likely related to lifting weights and being physically active, not the car crash, and that the most that Corey needed was 4 to 6 weeks of treatment. What I did in going through the deposition, which is basically locking him into the reasons he was saying that, what I was working on this whole time was something I learned from Keith Mitnick about locking them into their story and then showing that that's not part of the sensible sequence of events. That doesn't even make any sense. The way I do it is, again, I lock down the facts. I get him committed to the 4 to 6 weeks. I get him committed to his financial information, which we had at that point, which, of course, we can't discuss. I got him committed to how much of this work he does, practice versus
forensic type work.
Thank you. Medical legal work is the term I'm looking for. We nail him down on that, make sure there's nothing else he has to add, and then get out of there. And then I use that information in his cross-examination to basically show the jury how unreasonable he's being. In fact, I was able to use it in opening.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, going with the Keith Mitnick, the best time to cross an expert is in opening. And I know from reading your summary that you're saying that the jurors were already ready for Dr. Stoll when he came in. How did you address him in opening?
One of the concessions that I got from Dr. Stoll during his depositions is that he's a professional witness. I called him Dr. Stoll when I put his name on the board, and I called him doctor when he was on the stand out of respect. But other than that, I refer to him in opening and closing, the professional witness who the defense paid a lot of money to. That's how I refer to him. The primer on crossing him goes all the way back to Vore Dyer. And in Vore Dyer, you basically, obviously, you can't get into the facts. I got into, are you comfortable looking at somebody who might have way more education than you, like a doctor? Are you comfortable calling their credibility into question? Are you comfortable doing something like that?
Wow.
If you don't get any answers, I use the please talk to me from Nick Rowley, or I'll just say, how do you feel about that? And we got some good answers. And basically the jury was like, a couple of people were like, as long as they're on the stand, I'm comfortable with figuring out whether they're basically full of it or not.
Right.
And so that's where it starts. And then the second part is you hit him an opening and you talk about all the stuff that he testified to in his deposition, 4 to 6 weeks.
You were saying 4 to 6 weeks to get typical report we've all seen 1,000 times, right?
Exactly. And so in opening, I hit him with, you're going to learn this professional witness is paid to testify for the defense all the time. 80% of his professional witness work is for defense attorneys. He gets paid a lot of money from defense attorneys. I said, you're going to find out how much he gets paid later in trial. But what I can tell you is already in this case, he's been paid $14,000 to read some records, to do a report, and to come here to court today. Now, mind you, he's never even met Corey. And so then I had a slide up with his picture on it and all that. I said, so just so you guys know, this is how you're going to know when Dr. Stoll gets here. The defense is going to get up. That attorney, Mr. Bockel, is going to get up and he's going to say, the defense calls Dr. Philip Stoll. And you're going to see this man walk through the back door and he's really well-groomed. He's going to be wearing a nice suit. And he has got huge credentials. Like he went to Yale Medical School. He's a licensed orthopedic surgeon, huge credentials. And so that's how you're going to know he's here. Now, they already know all the stuff that he's going to say that's unreasonable. And the way that played out was exactly like Keith Mitnick said. I mean, I almost started laughing or clapping when it happened because I'd done this before and it didn't work out quite as well.
Right.
They walk in and they're smug and Dr. Stoll is quite arrogant by accounts of other people than myself. But he walks in, you know, and he's got his backpack and his nice suit. And he walks in and gets to the jury and smiles and nods. And two jurors just scowled at him. I mean, they just scowled at him. And the other ones looked at him like he didn't have any pants on, like he was a clown. It was wild. I was like, holy smokes, that whole setup worked.
Let me ask you this on that whole setup, because I'm curious. Did you do the Mitnick? Okay, so 4 to 6 weeks. So the very same pain on 6 weeks, and then the next day you did all that during cross of him live and not during his depo?
Correct. You don't do that during the depo. I'll give it to you real quick how we did it. When I did it, we were required to stand at the podium for witness exam. Judge Hernandez was actually nice and let us use the well as long as we weren't examining witnesses. But at any rate, I got him locked. That was the point of the depositions, get him locked into this 4 to 6 weeks. And after that, it's pre-existing degeneration. And I leave it at that. I leave it at that in depo. Because you don't want to tip your hand and you don't want to let him know that you're going to make him look like a fool. And so I told him, I said, okay, Dr. Stoll, you know, you've been very thorough with your answers. Of course, it's leading questions with yes answers, but he's smarter than me. So he's got to re-explain it to the jury. I just let him go. I said, okay, Dr. Stoll, I understand what you're saying here, but let me get this right. So for Corey, for 45 years of his life, he had never gone to the doctor. There's no medical records or anything about any injuries with his neck, back. I had a list on an easel so I could easily remember them in front of the jury. We actually admitted that as an exhibit. And I went down the list. I said, so he had none of that. And then this crash happens. And you say, doctor, that at most he had some mild sprain strains of his cervical spine, his lumbar spine, and his right shoulder. And then you're saying like 6 to 8 weeks later, he went to bed with neck pain, shoulder pain, low back pain, and sore knees. And when he got up the next day, it was that very moment that this degeneration and aging process you've been telling us about decided to rear his ugly head. And now none of these pains that he had the night before related to the crash, now they're all pre-existing degeneration. Is that what you're telling this jury? And I looked at the jury and they were looking at me like this. They were like, what is going on? And he did exactly what Keith Mitnick said he was going to do. He hawed. He's like, what do you want me to say? You've heard my testimony. I said, doctor, I just want you to answer the question. Are you saying this is all a big coincidence? Yes.
Wow. You got to do the coincidence thing too. I love it.
I said, you're telling us this is all just a big coincidence. And he was frustrated and angry and we stayed polite, professional. And he said, yes. And so my next question was, doctor, you made X amount of money working for the defense in 2021, correct? And he didn't want to talk about it. I said, well, doctor, you filled out an affidavit And we got the affidavit and took it up to him. Does this refresh your memory? You made X number of dollars in 2021 doing this work, didn't you? Well, you know, the paper says, and I said, doctor, I'm asking you, what do you want me to say? I said, doctor, I just want you to answer my question, please. Did you make X number of dollars on this year doing this work? And you see, Emily's starting to smile because it was bad for him. And he says, yes. And then in 2022, you made X number of dollars, which was a little bit less than 2021. Yes. And in 2023, you made the same amount of money. Yes. Thank you, doctor. I appreciate your time. That was it.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah.
One other area before we wrap up that I was hoping you could touch on is, how did you all deal with, either one of you, deal with the fact that your client didn't get the injections? Because we've had these same cases. They come in and clients are, I don't want to do injections. Your client is not getting injections. How did that play out with respect to the failure to mitigate instruction? And how did you all deal with that at trial?
The defense had a non-pattern failure to mitigate instruction that left out the portion about basically if the surgery is dangerous, you can't hold that against him. We put forth a modified failure to mitigate that included the word injection. And knowing this was going to be an issue, we made sure that Dr. Gabriel testified that is a risk to injection, including paralysis and death. And he's like, it's a very slim risk, but it's a risk. So we basically argued to the judge, well, he didn't do it because it's dangerous. He's afraid of needles and it's dangerous. And that was all testified to. So the jury should know that this rule exists. And after some extensive back and forth, the judge ruled that our instruction was to be the one given. And our instruction was very close to the pattern instruction. And I don't know if the jury did a deduction. I don't think they did based on the number we got. That's how it panned out. And Emily, one thing she didn't mention that she did, we did do a motion for exemplary damages, which based on the hit and run, which was ultimately denied. We didn't renew that at the end of trial. We felt it was going pretty well. We really wanted to make sure we didn't appear greedy.
So that motion denied the, there is a failure to mitigate instruction that's given, but did it list, it said, just paraphrase, did the instruction basically say you don't have to mitigate if it's a risky procedure like having an injection?
Yeah, you don't have to mitigate if it's basically there are serious risks such as an injection or surgery.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
What an amazing result. And one of the things that I'm just so inspired by, specifically how all the Keith Mitnick things played out to a T with your trial, yeah, including Dr. Stull. But the real takeaways I take from this are the subpoena Dukas Tecum for the experts' financials and prior reports and fighting that fight, because I know we all get busy, and do we want to fight this fight? And Glenn, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that you have offered to the CTLA listserv and other the actual subpoena that you served and the briefing associated with the motion to compel. Is that accurate?
It absolutely is. And so what I've been telling people, I've got a small Facebook group, and I'll ask about plugging that later.
Yeah, please.
It's on Facebook. It's called PI Lawyers Discussing RWTB. PI Lawyers Discussing RWTB. And basically, we just talk about running with the bulls concepts. But what I've done for them and I've offered to the listserv is, if you want my outlines for voir dire, opening, closing, you can have those. If you want any of the subpoenas we issued, you can have those. If you want the motions in limine, you can have those. The only thing you can't have is Dr. Stull's deposition transcript, because it's under a protection order, which also includes his financials and his disclosed reports. So I can't give you those, but I'm willing to give you everything else.
Fantastic. And how do listeners get in touch with you if maybe they want to work on some cases with you or just have questions? How do they get in touch with you?
So we are more than happy to help and discuss. And if we can have an hour-long phone call and it makes it so you can settle a case, we actually did that with another lawyer about a month ago, helped that lawyer get policy limits. It's great. There was no co-counsel agreement. He got to, you know, him and his client got to keep all the money. Awesome. You can just give us a call at Oakmont Law Group. The number is 720-645-1123. If you're trying to get me on the phone, it's a little difficult. You can imagine my phone's been blowing up from people all over the country over this last couple of weeks. Jana is my office manager. She runs my calendar for me. So she will put something on. You can also reach Emily at the same number. And then my email is Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, at oakmont.law, And Emily's email is Emily, E-M-I-L-Y, at oakmont.law.
Well, fantastic. I cannot thank you all enough for sharing what you learned and coming on the podcast. It has absolutely inspired me to get back in that arena as soon as I possibly can. And I mean, you took a case with $30,000 in meds and had multiple million-dollar policy demands and end up getting a $3 million verdict for all intents and purposes. So kudos to you and your entire team. And one of the things I most admire about you is your, and I know from reading all of your listserv posts, your never-ending desire to keep learning and keep becoming better. So thank you, sincerely. Thank you both for being on the podcast. And I look forward to seeing you guys in person soon again.
Thank you, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration from today's courtroom warriors. And thank you for being in the arena. Make sure to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to dissect real cases and learn from Colorado's top trial lawyers. Our mission is to empower our legal community, helping us to become better trial lawyers to effectively represent our clients. Keep your connection to Colorado's best trial lawyers alive at www.thectlc.com.